Firms across the European Union have made it clear they very much want to do business with the Islamic Republic. Economists say US banking-related sanctions against Tehran are stifling that business. There is now some optimism that change is coming because Joe Biden has indicated the US will rejoin the nuclear accord, which was signed by Iran and six world powers in 2015 and underpinned by the United Nations. With the possibility that US sanctions against Tehran will be lifted, EU businesses should prepare to start trading, experts suggest.
I think it probably makes sense to move now and to be one of the early players in the right framework, of course.
With a population greater than 80 million people, Iran represents a big opportunity for EU firms, it has been pointed out. The 27-country bloc, which is heavily dependent on energy imports, could also address fuel security issues.
Iran would have its energy fields, its gas and oil, which are huge, some of the biggest in the world, opened again to markets, in particular the European market, which would be, you know, a beneficiary of this.
Tehran says Washington can only rejoin the JCPOA if there are no preconditions. Since entering the White House last week, Joe Biden has already spoken with Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron about the nuclear deal. The big unknown right now is, will Biden be willing or able to stand up to those who want to see the agreement completely disintegrate? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkey and Greece held their first direct talk in 5 years over tensions which grew between the two neighboring countries over the past years. Turkey has been at loggerheads with Greece and Cyprus over an energy-rich area in the Mediterranean Sea. Tensions flared up last year after Ankara deployed an exploration vessel to the contested waters. The move foundered plans for the resumption of Athens-Ankara negotiations that had been stalled since 2016. The two sides were still trading barbs in the days leading up to the meetings. Last week, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said his country will attend those talks with optimism, but, quote, zero naivety. Issues that are on the agenda of the delegations are bilateral disputes, maritime boundaries, and drilling rights.
In talks with Greece, we hope that the issues will be dealt with within the framework of rights, law, and equity, and the solutions are found. We hope that Greece respects our rights in the Aegean and Eastern Mediterranean and avoids actions that may cause misunderstandings.
The meetings were held with international optimism as well, especially from the EU. Analysts say this whole meeting was due to the bloc's pressure on both sides and voiced concerns over the delegations failing to reach an agreement.
The two sides met to agree on several points. Greece wants to discuss East Mediterranean and Turkey wants to discuss arming Aegean islands. Therefore, they will need more time to reach a common ground, and I think it's hard for both sides to reach an agreement, just like it was in the previous talks. I think the talks are being held mainly due to the EU pressure.
This is the 61st negotiations between the two, as talks were initiated in March 2002 and stopped in 2016 without reaching an agreement. Hopes seem high about the outcome of the talks, but given previous experiences, observers say the disputes between Turkey and Greece need more than this to be resolved. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iran is now capable of relaying messages that are impervious to hacking. The method is called quantum cryptography. The new technique is used to ensure the absolute confidentiality of information transmitted between two parties by exploiting the random behavior of elementary particles, namely photons.
The new method uses what we call quantum entanglement of photons to encode messages that can never be cracked by a third party. It's a totally new chapter in cryptography, and we just did it. We first built the lab-scale device in 2018, and tonight the first industrial version was successfully used for a longer distance.
The encoded messages were transmitted between Tehran's Milad Tower and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, which are over 1.5 kilometers apart. Experts say the Iranian device can transmit encrypted messages within a maximum of 7 kilometers at this point. This is why the device's foreign counterparts can communicate messages within over 100 kilometers. Officials say they're working on more capable quantum cryptographers that would transmit secure messages between Tehran and Fordo nuclear facility, which is some 300 kilometers away.
In the next step, we will relay quantum encrypted messages between Milad Tower and Azadi Tower, which are 7 kilometers apart. This will happen in 5 months. The last step will be to transmit entangled photons using optical fiber from Tehran to Fordo nuclear site. This will be possible in 1 or 2 years.
Quantum entanglement was first observed by German physicist Albert Einstein a century ago, when he witnessed that any change in one of the two entangled particles leads to an immediate response in its pair, even if they're separated light years away from each other. Baffled by the phenomenon, Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. Although the process has been formulated mathematically, logically, it's still unfathomable. Today, the phenomenon is widely used not only in quantum encryption, but in biology, computation, and space technologies.
The random behavior of subatomic particles is still a mystery. But scientists have managed to tap into a range of its applications, including quantum cryptography. Officials say Iran is now among the few countries that possess the technology. What's ahead is to generate such uncrackable codes for longer distances. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
On the Global Day of Action for Yemen, Yemenis from all walks of life took the streets in the capital Sana'a and other major cities to denounce the U.S. terrorist designation of the Ansarullah movement. The demonstrators voiced their support for the Ansarullah movement and called on U.S. administration to reverse the decision.
The demonstration comes as a reaction to 6 years of killing, blockade and targeting of Yemen with barges, planes and missiles. People here are against the U.S. move, viewing it as a meddling in their internal affairs.
The Yemeni people came out to send this clear message that they will not sit back against the growing pressure. They rallied to denounce the U.S. policies and hold it accountable for most of the pressure imposed on them over the past years.
Demonstrators also confirmed that the Ansarullah movement is an inseparable part of Yemen and they are determined to defend Yemen against the Saudi-led coalition's war. Earlier, over 170 Yemeni NGOs condemned U.S. terrorists designation of Ansarullah.
U.S. served as the main source of terrorism in the world. It is a great Satan. America is the main sponsor of Daesh, Al-Qaeda, and all attack-free groups in the region.
Yemenis will survive the unjust pressure imposed on them. They will not give up resistance and will continue to fight for their independence and dignity.
Since the beginning of 2015, Yemenis have been suffering from war and siege imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition, during which war crimes were committed and international humanitarian law was violated by killing thousands of women and children.
Yemenis say the U.S. decision is not against a specific group, but rather against a nation severely suffering from war and the blockade imposed by Washington's allies in the region. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Together against poverty, Iran's volunteer Basij Force organization has launched a charity campaign that aims to identify and help the needy from different religious minorities. The humanitarian move was announced during a press conference attended by representatives of Christian and Jewish communities in Iran's parliament.
I should thank the Basij Force for this benevolent act, where it factored out the issue of faith and focused on humanity in its charity affairs. The Armenian community has always considered Iran a home, and this will definitely make the recipients of charities happier.
Philanthropy has been a common feature of Iranians since the ancient past. U.S. Jews have been living peacefully in Iran since 2,700 years ago. Today, we witness this friendship and brotherhood in this act of benefaction.
The aid includes staple food and other basic needs, along with cash handouts that cover an average family's monthly spending. The Basij Force says the charity move comes as many families are suffering under growing economic pressure, stemming from inflation and exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic.
We hope that the unwelcome virus will soon be eliminated, but for now, we cannot ignore the fact that many people have lost a significant portion of their income due to the pandemic, and it's upon us to extend the hand of help to them, no matter what religion they practice and what color their skin is.
Iran is a predominantly Muslim country, but it's also home to followers of other religions, such as Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians,
organizers here say, regardless of their religious beliefs, these minorities are Iranians. They believe such humanitarian events strengthen national bonds and foster peaceful coexistence.
Organizers say humanitarian efforts transcend faith and ethnicity. This is especially the case during the pandemic, which has gripped all people, many of whom have lost their income and now depend on such donations to make ends meet. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Revocation of autonomous status, unprecedented security clampdown, then the COVID pandemic. Last 17 months have been full of darkness and uncertainty in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The months-long lockdown has left the region's economy shattered. According to official statistics, the economy suffered losses of over $5 billion. Tourism industry, which is considered the mainstay of Kashmir's economy, has been one of the worst sufferers. Now, following months of lull, Kashmir's tourist hubs are coming back to life. Winter snow has brought tourists back to the picturesque Himalayan region and raised hope among those associated with the tourism industry. The world-famous ski resort Gulmarg is abuzz with tourists these days.
The losses are humongous. And as far as expectation is concerned, Kashmir tourism is all about hope and expectations. I mean, for the last 20-25 years, entire world knows that we have been running tourism in very, very challenging situations.
Tourism industry, particularly hoteliers in Kashmir, suffered huge losses, first due to scrapping of Article 370 and then due to global pandemic. New Year has brought glamour of hope with tourists returning to Kashmir.
Yeah, this is the first time I'm here. I'm very happy from the core of my heart. I always feel like I'm on the ninth cloud.
The tourism department is organizing various events in a bid to attract more tourists in order to revive the industry. After Winter Games, Gulmarg is now hosting snow sculpting competition. Braving sub-zero temperature, the participants are working with great passion to produce some of the finest works of art. Meanwhile, a 31-member Indian parliamentary delegation is also here to promote tourism. The visiting delegation also met various stakeholders of the region's tourism sector. Situated at an altitude of 2,730 meters above sea level, Gulmarg boasts of one of the highest cable cars in the world. With breathtaking slopes, Gulmarg is one of the finest ski destinations in the world and the heartland of winter sports in India.
Wrapped in a thick carpet of snow, the ski resort of Gulmarg presents a delightful picture these days. It offers best slopes for skiers and attracts sports and adventure lovers from across the world, and also raises hopes for tourism revival in Kashmir. Sadri Safi from Gulmarg Ski Resort, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The number of people sleeping on the streets at night across the European Union is growing by the day amid the pandemic. Welfare systems are under enormous strain. We have been speaking to one homeless man in Brussels who is finding it difficult to acquire emergency accommodation.
It's very hard in the cold, in the winter. It's very hard to feel good, to find somewhere. It's very difficult.
A debate on the worsening social crisis in the EU resulting from COVID-19 has been held in the European Parliament.
We have a problem here. The slow, sluggish bureaucracy of the European Union is not compatible with emergencies like the one we face today.
Governments in the EU are being urged to submit pandemic recovery plans to the European Commission so that €750 billion in available funding can be released without any further delay.
Millions of people lost already their jobs. And they are mainly the low-skilled, the low-paid workers, the temporary workers, the young on precarious work.
The European Parliament debate was told the EU social crisis could last for many years unless action is taken to save economies.
Thousands of businesses have temporarily or permanently closed. Millions of Europeans have lost their jobs and livelihoods.
Many EU legislators say the 27-country bloc's vaccination programme is being delivered too slowly. To make matters worse, experts in the UK are suggesting the new variant of COVID-19 discovered last year in England might be more deadly than previously thought.
EU officials are concerned new variants of the disease might be resistant to approved vaccines and vaccines awaiting approval. With that comes obvious health concerns, but also incredible economic uncertainty. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics is that has found that large swaths of mostly young and highly educated Italians have continued to move abroad in search of working opportunities. Italy's young workers have been living for decades. However, the report has highlighted that over 300,000 Italians aged 18 to 39 emigrated to neighboring European countries and overseas between 2015 and 2019, up 33% compared to 2014. One in three of them were graduates.
These figures show that young Italians, particularly from the rich north, choose to leave the country because the labor market doesn't offer them any prospects. This is why young people from the depressed Italy south continue to emigrate to northern cities. We are calling on the government to invest more in the youth, in its recovery and resilience plan, the investment project using European Union funds to counter the effect of the pandemic.
Youth unemployment level in Italy stands at about 40%. Furthermore, 3 out of 10 Italians between 18 and 24 years of age are not in employment, education or training, the third highest percentage among OECD countries.
A recent study by the European Commission has found that Italy, along with Poland and Romania, is among the European countries that send the most workers abroad. This brain drain costs Italy an estimated 14 billion euros every year.
It's an inconceivable waste. Once trained through our school system, our young Italians offer their skills to foreign countries. It's true, our labor market is stagnant, but it must be said that quite often the system does not reward merit.
Successive Italian governments had long tried attracting back talented workers with tax breaks, with no success. However, a counter-exodus of the brain drain seems to be underway since the start of the pandemic. Data from Italy's foreign ministry shows that in 2020, the number of young Italians returning home increased about 20% over the previous year. Max Civili, Rome.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The article you're about to hear under the heading Homeless Encampment Evictions Highlight the Cruelty of Capitalism Amid COVID has been written by Aziza Kanji, who is a legal scholar and writer based in Toronto, Canada. Aziza Kanji is a regular opinion contributor to Canadian and international media on issues relating to racism, law, and social justice. Stay with us for more of Aziza Kanji's article. In Canada's homeless encampments, two faces of state brutality are on display. One is the organized abandonment that has relegated hundreds of thousands across Canada to homelessness at twice the rate as in the United States. The other is the organized violence that evicts homeless people from encampments erected in the shadow of the state's malign neglect. In Toronto, for example, Canada's largest and most unequal city, frontline workers estimate there are currently 1,000 to 2,000 people sleeping in dozens of encampments outdoors, several times more than the 400 acknowledged by city officials. Against the advice of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Housing, the municipality has been raising encampments in the name of safety and health, relocating people to institutional spaces that are far from healthy or safe. "Nobody cares about us," said Moss Park encampment resident Cassie. "It's like we're bedbug in their building and they just want to exterminate us." Even before the pandemic, Toronto's dangerously overcrowded shelter system was a petri dish for disease transmission, to quote longtime street nurse Kathy Crowe. A study published recently in the Canadian Medical Association Journal found COVID-19 infection rates of 41.7% in one large Toronto shelter. In the city's shelter hotels, hotel is nothing but name, people report being uprooted from their support networks, required to room with strangers, and surprised with intrusive wellness checks. Since they are permitted to bring only two bags of possessions with them, many leave poorer than when they arrive. Meanwhile, in temporary respites, physical distancing is achieved by caging people in transparent glass boxes, whilst the lights have been left on for 24 hours a day. The imposition of such solutions to homelessness, without consulting homeless people themselves, exemplifies the state's violent benevolence, in which instrumental violence is narrated as gentle or non-violent, even when it's violent and is experienced as oppressive, in the words of anti-poverty scholar activist A.J. Withers and critical social work academic Chris Chapman. Even in the frigid temperatures of winter, many homeless people are deciding to sleep outside instead, or are forced to by the persistent shelter unavailability. Contrary to Toronto's claims of increased capacity during the pandemic, there are 1,158 fewer shelter spaces available this winter in Toronto as compared to last winter. 61% of requests received by the city for shelter are simply turned away. Many of the people sleeping in encampments know people who have died outside in the winter, social worker Kirsten Howard attested to Toronto City Council. "I am asking you to consider how bad the system must be for them to prefer to take that risk than to deal with the inadequate shelter system." In apparent dissociation from this reality, city press releases applaud the extraordinary steps taken to help and protect people experiencing homelessness during COVID-19 pandemic. The Canadian government presents a menu of bad options, then expects gratitude for the crumbs dispensed. And its press release proclaim, Toronto consistently places at the top of international rankings due to investments championed by its government, residents and businesses. Left unmentioned is that these international rankings include being one of the most unaffordable cities in the world, having one of the largest super-rich wealth gaps in the world, and being the child poverty capital of a country that has one of the highest child poverty rates in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. Toronto spends almost five times more on policing than on shelter and housing. At the current legislated minimum wage, a worker would have to work 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, to affordably rent an apartment in Toronto. The waiting list for social housing is 7 to 10 years long. All levels of Canadian government have stripped funding for vital social goods like housing to the bone, while fattening institutions such as the military and the police. Even money ostensibly allocated for social welfare has in some cases turned out to be yet more police enrichment by another route. For example, 99% of the Ontario government's $200 million grant for community safety and well-being ended up back in police coffers. Meanwhile, in the disaster opportunism of the pandemic, the provincial government has further extended its own emergency powers for up to 2 years, while measures protecting those who rent from eviction have been ripped away. In fact, evictions have been further facilitated with the new perversely named Protecting Tenants and Strengthening Community Housing Act, known as the Evictions Act, by those on the receiving end of its protection. While corporate landlords have continued to reap large profit margins, impoverished tenants have been forced to beg for their homes in mass online eviction hearings, 7,000 in the month of November alone. These eviction hearings are a pipeline to encampments, observer and lawyer Dania Majid of the Advocacy Centre for Tenants Ontario said. In Toronto, 600 new people have been entering the shelter system every month, according to the city's own data, which has a pattern of understating the numbers to make the problem disappear, if only on paper. Having jettisoned the possibility of ensuring genuinely affordable housing and a livable wage, the state directs its resources towards penalizing the survival strategies of the dispossessed. The Ontario Superior Court has refused to suspend Toronto bylaws prohibiting people from sleeping in parks, maintaining that parks are public resources intended to be available and used by everyone, except apparently by homeless people for activities necessary for life. As Brendan Jowett, one of the lawyers who brought the case, argues, what was really at stake was not whether people can use public parks for recreation, but whether people can use public parks without being reminded of the city's social ills. Even efforts to mitigate the state's public cruelty with private generosity have been disciplined. Carpenter Khalil Saveright was threatened by the city with legal action for constructing tiny shelters for people sleeping outside. With the expansion of pandemic policing powers, the burden of intensified harassment has been primarily by homeless people, Indigenous peoples and Black people, the same shoulders on which the greatest share of police brutality has long been inflicted. In recent years, Toronto cops have been caught targeting homeless people with hefty fines for fabricating offences in order to increase their numbers. After forfeiting a few days' pay, these police officers have been permitted back onto the beat, making $100,000 plus per year. The state traps homeless people in an impossible position. They are deprived of their housing, but prohibited from sleeping rough, sleeping in public places. They are denied public washroom and shower facilities, but punished for performing necessary bodily functions outside. A fundamental feature of the rule of law is that the law must be possible to obey. Instead of the rule of law, homeless people are subjected to the law of rule, crushed under the force of law's punishment, but excluded from its protection. Housing is a human right under international law, yet in Canadian, as in United States courts, this basic floor of human entitlement is treated as an unattainable ceiling. Instead of serving as a much-hoped-for portal to a more just future, the coronavirus pandemic has been a time warp, remolding old inequalities to fit the new reality. Wealthy corporations have been giving millions of dollars in government aid, while social assistance recipients living below poverty line have had their benefits clawed back. Settler squatters, corporations and governments appropriate indigenous lands with impunity, whilst homeless people are punished for sleeping in parks. The forms of violence involved in sustaining this unjust social order imperil public health. Environmental exploitation destroys biodiversity, enabling the emergence of new diseases. Evictions deprive people of their shelter, whilst telling them to shelter in place. Deportations force people to travel, facilitating viral spread. Police brutalization brings people into closer contact with police officers who aren't required to wear face masks. Mass incarceration exposes prisoners to mass infection. Racialization concentrates these harms in non-white communities, which non-coincidentally have suffered the pandemic's greatest toll. The coronavirus pandemic is a global reminder of what many have never been allowed to forget: the stifling inequality engendered by capitalism takes lives, sometimes quickly and very often slowly. With encampment evictions, the state punishes those being suffocated for gasping to breathe.
The debate.
Welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. January 25th is the International Day of Action on Yemen. On the occasion, 24 British MPs urged the Foreign Secretary to stop the continuous supply of weapons to the Saudi-led coalition. In their memo, the legislators reminded the reality that British-made bombs are being used in Saudi airstrikes that have claimed the lives of thousands of Yemeni civilians, including women and children. It's estimated that London has sold £15 billion worth of UK-made arms to Saudi Arabia since the start of the war. Ironically, world powers providing Riyadh with lethal weapons preach human rights and international humanitarian law, but they don't seem to be inclined to stop benefiting from war and bloodshed.
In yet another effort to stop Saudi Arabia's devastating war in Yemen, this time 24 British Parliament members have urged Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to halt the country's arms sales to Riyadh. In a letter, they have underlined that up to £15 billion worth of UK-made arms have been sold to the Saudi regime since it launched a war on Yemen in 2015. The letter also cites a recent UN report on the situation in Yemen, adding that the war has already claimed 233,000 lives, while about 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Many political experts believe that the Saudi-led war is being perceived globally as unwarranted and genocidal.
The global perception now about the Yemen war, if nothing else,
is that this was unwarranted and genocidal. I mean, there's no justification for it. And it was a Saudi assault, but orchestrated by UK and US military personnel. Officers were in the Saudi capital from the very beginning. And of course, all the weaponry that the Saudi military uses in this genocidal assault is US and UK military hardware.
Since 2015, the Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen have devastated much of the poor country's infrastructure, with the UN calling it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Half of Yemen's population is now on the brink of famine, many of them children. The country has also experienced the world's worst cholera outbreak and now struggling with an alarming COVID-related death rate. From the onset of war, many international rights groups and activists have slammed the West in general and the United States, Britain, France, and Canada in particular for their support for the Saudi-led coalition. They have repeatedly called on these governments to suspend weapon sales to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. In September, a UN experts group named Canada for the first time as the one perpetuating the conflict in Yemen by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. So far, international calls have fallen on deaf ears as not only Saudi Arabia continues with its bombing campaign and blockade of Yemen, but its Western backers too continue supplying the regime with lethal weapons. It seems that what matters to Western powers most is putting their profit out of arms exports to their repressive Arab regimes above human rights and the lives of millions of impoverished Yemenis.
Okay, now that was Mehdi Farahman with his report. Let me now invite our guests to this debate show. We'll have Director of the Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sheriff, out of London, and journalist and historian Brecht Junkers out of Hasselt. Good to have you with us both on the show. Let's go to London. Kim, British MPs believe it's appalling that London continues to supply arms to what they call one of the most autocratic regimes on earth, and that's despite a 2019 Court of Appeal ruling that such sales are illegal. So on what ground does London keep selling weapons to the Saudis?
No grounds other than alleging from time to time that it is economically viable for Britain to do so, and that there is this kind of alliance or a special relationship between the Saudi regime and the UK government in relation to cooperation on matters of terrorism. And when in fact we know that terrorism and its source is actually the Saudi regime itself. According to Just the Law, according to MBS himself, he had admitted on live TV, according to Hillary Clinton, we know the history of the Mujahideen, so it's all false claims. And what really matters here is basically making those weapon sales deals, because there are lots and lots of backhanders involved. That is my view, and I'm basing this view on the case of the Al-Yamama scandal, which led to a huge investigation and intervention by the government of the time to stop the investigation continuing by the Serious Fraud Office. And of course, there are these scandalous background issues that need to be taken into account. Second issue, I have just stated that terrorism, which is completely nonsense. The third issue is Britain's empirical need to have control of Yemen itself. And it's basically a party to this conflict without being directly involved in it, in the sense that, you know, not sending thousands of troops, but sending all the experts to be in the Riyadh war rooms, sending the weapons, sending the logistics, sending the intelligence, sending every possible help you can think about. So it is really effectively, in reality, is Britain's war without getting parliamentary consent for this intervention in the affairs of a sovereign state called Yemen. Now, what needs to be done? Yes, the letter today was absolutely refreshing, and I'm delighted to see that great many high-profile MPs and QCs signing it, demanding that this government comply with the law of the land, mm-hmm. because the Court of Appeal decision is binding on everybody, not just on ordinary citizen Joe Blog from the streets. It's binding on everybody, including the members of the government. Now, what I would like to ask, and this is a question from a lawyer, a legitimate question, why aren't the other parties of Parliament doing what is right to hold the government to account in court? Because if somebody is disobeying a court order, that somebody is in contempt of court. And being in contempt of court is a very, very serious offence under English law. As far as I know, it's almost always automatic imprisonment. So why aren't we seeing some kind of serious steps along these lines to hold the government to account? Because, as I said, Court of Appeal decision is a very, very serious decision, which comes right. from a higher court of the land, and therefore it is embarrassing why the other parties are just not taking this necessary legal step to hold the government to account.
Right. Now, Brecht, there are some harrowing facts and figures that have been mentioned in this British memos, MP's memo, like the fact that the war has taken 233,000 lives, many of them women and children, as you know, and also the fact that 80% of the population in Yemen, like 24 million people, they need urgent humanitarian assistance. Instead of offering philanthropic aid to the Yemenis, London is selling lethal weapons to the Saudis to take their lives. Would London ever stop this profiteering and put human lives first?
Well, I think that really depends on who's in power in London, and also, very importantly, of course, who is pushing in which direction, both in Parliament and especially also in the streets of England. So I think it's therefore a very, very important signal when we saw this global day of action for Yemen yesterday, in which there were thousands and thousands of people worldwide rallying both in the streets wherever possible and in online rallies wherever going to the streets was impossible due to COVID-19, of course. This is a massive pressure, and it's a sort of lobbying of the streets, if you will, that is, I think, of a critical importance if you want to change anything, especially in a country that is so set in its ways like the United Kingdom. Indeed, we have seen that the United Kingdom has had government after government who only puts the interests of its share of the shareholders, of the corporations, of the big companies, as above anything else, and doesn't really care much about human lives, and especially human lives in the third world. And this is unfortunately something that has been shown across parties, where we've been seeing this during the leadership of Tony Blair in the time of the Iraq War. We have seen this during the various Tory governments that we have seen since then. And we have seen this both in Iraq, we have seen this in Afghanistan, we are seeing this now in Yemen, that no matter how many times people bring on in the media the fact that there are so many millions of Yemenis suffering from starvation, from disease, from these bombings, from the blockade that is directly brought about by the Saudi and UAE invasion of Yemen. For the longest time, this war has been going on for nearly 6 years. In March 2021, it will be 6 years of continuous war in Yemen. And yet it has taken until now almost for, let's say, the mainstream media to take some sort of an attention, some sort of note, and for it to become really something, a topic of discussion in Parliament. And that is thanks to the pressure of the people in the street, the heroic actions done by ordinary British people and by certain politicians in the British establishment, unfortunately, who have taken it on themselves to pressure for righteousness and justice. So all in all, I am, let's say, optimistic, cautiously optimistic, that after all these years of activity, of people who have been rallying for Yemen, been writing about Yemen, been trying to get international attention to Yemen, that there is finally somewhat of a mainstream light being shed on the Yemeni situation. And I believe this is the only way in which we can sway the United States and the United Kingdom and France from supporting the UAE and supporting Saudi Arabia, and for them to finally get their, you know, their greedy mitts off of this country and let Yemen finally restore itself in peace and prosperity.
Okay. Now, Kim, let's now turn to another arms supply for Saudis, France. Brock just mentioned France's name. The country that claims respect for international humanitarian law, it makes the protection of civilians in conflicts one of its top priorities. And then you see France providing Riyadh rulers with weapons despite widely documented violations by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. And for instance, in 2019, France sold arms to Saudis worth 1.4 billion euros. Your take on that?
Well, France, it's amazing. It does claim to be a country that respects human rights and humanitarian laws, but in reality, it's completely the opposite of that. I mean, recent evidence is the yellow vest demonstrations and the brutality of the French police towards those poor people who are demanding their basic rights. So where is respect for human rights in there? People had their eyes poked out. And then you have France's very, very odd relationship with African nations. France is a very ambitious country that likes to pretend that it respects human rights, but in reality, it's completely the opposite of that. It is also the third colonial power in the Security Council, and it always goes in the footsteps of Britain and the US. So whatever the two big brothers do, France follows along. So all three nations have, unfortunately, very, very bad record of respect for human rights and international humanitarian laws, not least because of the serious crimes that have been repeatedly committed in relation to Yemen for the past 6 years, leading to the worst man-made humanitarian catastrophe. It's not just a catastrophe, it's man-made. So who is this man who's making this catastrophe? Well, right. You have three crowds of people doing it. You've got a Saudi coalition, who are the middlemen, the proxies. You have their own sub-proxies, who are the terrorist militias, ACAP and Daesh, euphemistically referred to as ground forces of Adi. And of course, you have in the background the main backers and suppliers of all of this, Britain, France, and the US. So it's very, very unfortunate that humanity reaches this level of blatant disrespect of human rights and commission of hideous crimes with impunity and total lack of accountability and responsibility. Human conscience is almost dying as a result of this very, very painful scenario to have to be dealing with.
All right, Brecht, Kim mentioned the U.S. Let's take a look at the U.S. And his campaign, President Joe Biden, promised to put an end to U.S. support for the war in Yemen. He called Saudi Arabia a pariah and stated that he would make it very clear that his administration would halt weapon sales to Riyadh. Would he do that?
Again, this is something which I would say cautious optimism is the key word here, because yes, we know that Joe Biden has indeed spoken some very strong words against Saudi Arabia and has spoken out in a very harsh way against Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi regime in particular. Unfortunately, I think many of those phrases were mostly spoken as a result of the murder of Jamal al-Khashoggi and not so much the millions of people who were suffering in Yemen, which is again a sort of double standard in the West. But it is, let's say, it's a step in the right direction. I wouldn't necessarily rely on Joe Biden per se to get all of this done, but there are certain members of Congress and of both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate who have been very outspoken critics, and it is possible that they will push Biden in the right direction and, for example, introduce a new war powers resolution. These are people such as Representative Rokana and Bernie Sanders, of course. I think if the House of Representatives and the Senate indeed do pressure for a war powers resolution, in which they demand Joe Biden as president to stop supporting Saudi Arabia, which is the same resolution that they did a few years ago against Donald Trump. I have sort of confidence in it that Joe Biden will not go as far as vetoing this resolution in the way that Donald Trump did. However, that's why I say we have to be cautious about our and tempering our optimism and our expectation. We have to bear in mind that harsh words against Saudi Arabia before an election are actually not that new. Donald Trump himself in 2016, before he got elected, he was quite harsh in Saudi Arabia as well. He accused Hillary Clinton, his opponent in the race, of being way too soft in Saudi Arabia. He accused her of being a hypocrite because she, as a woman, supported a regime in which women have absolutely no human rights whatsoever. And he vowed that Saudi Arabia would not be allowed to get away with so much leeway as they had under Obama and all previous governments. Now, what turned out after the elections is that Trump became a better friend to Saudi Arabia than any other U.S. president in history. Mm-hmm. So there is always a big grain of salt that this has to be taken with, especially if we bear in mind that Joe Biden was vice president of the United States under the Obama administration when this war started in 2015. Mm-hmm. And with everything that Saudi Arabia does, you have to bear in mind, sir, Saudi Arabia will not do anything major without knowing that it has somewhat of a backing of a foreign power, most importantly, the United States. The Saudi Kingdom is a giant with clay feet. It is actually a very, very weak structure. They would not, launch into an offensive war, even against a country which is considered poor and defenseless, such as Yemen. They would not launch into this conflict if they didn't have some sort of permission from the United States, I believe. So the United States back then, under Democrat rule by Obama and Biden, supported the Saudi invasion. Biden was quite vocal about it, the fact that he supported this for the quote-unquote return of the legitimate government of Abdul Mansur Hadi. Right. Now, of course, he is coming around. He himself, Joe Biden, claims that this is because the war has been, let's say, too brutal, too inhumane. But he doesn't necessarily oppose, I believe, Saudi Arabia itself. He doesn't oppose the Hadi puppet regime. He doesn't oppose the fact that they are fighting against Ansar Allah and against the National Salvation Government in Sana'a. He just opposes this because it is getting too brutal and too bloody. So I don't think we can rely completely on Joe Biden himself to really have the audacity, like the courage, and have the moral compass to actually cut off Saudi Arabia himself. But I do believe that there is a possibility if certain good people that are still left over, hopefully in the Congress, were to push for this. With, of course, again, support from people in the street. We have seen massive protests also in the U.S. yesterday. For example, there was the car protest caravan in San Francisco that went specifically to the House of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, in order to demand that the Democratic Party does what it promises and cut off Saudi Arabia.
Right.
I believe if these people keep pressuring, and eventually Joe Biden will have no choice but to cut off Saudi Arabia completely.
Okay. Kim, I want to ask you about almost in the same lines. The Trump administration told Congress about plans to sell $500 million more worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and that was due to be implemented a few days ago, January 21st. It also designated Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist group. Would you expect the Biden administration to change course in Yemen, or will they follow in Trump's footsteps?
Well, I am an optimist. I'm hoping that he will. We will carry on our pressure. We will embarrass him, remind him of his promises pre-election, and try and hold him to account to that and not get away with it. But the difficulty is, I totally agree with your learned guest and what he said here by way of analysis and evidential backup to what he was saying. The war was started while Obama was the president, so we can't really count on the Democrats to be sensible people and do the right thing. In fact, they may well be using this kind of like harsh language against the Saudi regime as a means of attempting to milk the cow further and further. That is all what this is about. However, we will not stop our campaign, we will not stop our pressure. The evidence so far shows that he has relaxed the rules, which was imposed by his predecessor, a most disreputable individual. Everyone knows who that is. I don't even want to say his name, lest it dirties my mouth. He's relaxed some of the rules, but it was incumbent upon him to actually wave it all together and take it away, because it's ridiculous. You've seen how many millions of Yemenis came out into the streets of all the provinces under the National Salvation Government, showing support for the government of Sana'a. How can you call all these people terrorists? Children, women, elderly? That's ridiculous.
Exactly.